Chapter 14. Might be apparent only a way of turning his eyes that Mr. Farfrae had. She did not divine the ample explanation of his manner, without personal vanity, that was afforded by the fact of Donald being the depositary of Henchard's confidence in respect of his past treatment of the pale, chastened mother who walked by her side. Her conjectures on that pass never went further than faint ones based on things casually heard and seen, mere guesses, that Henchard and her mother might have been lovers in their younger days, who had quarreled and parted. Casterbridge, as has been hinted, was a place deposited in the block upon a cornfield. There was no suburb in the modern sense, or transitional intermixture of town and down. It stood, with regard to the white fertile land adjoining, clean-cut and distinct, like a chessboard on a green tablecloth. The farmer's boy could sit under his barley mow, and pitch a stone into the office window of the town clerk. Reapers at work among the sheaves nodded to acquaintances standing on the pavement corner. The red-robed judge, when he condemned a sheep-stealer, pronounced sentence to the tune of Bah, that floated in at the window from the remainder of the flock browsing hard by. And at executions the waiting crowd stood in a meadow immediately before the drop, out of which the cows had been temporarily driven to give the spectators room. The corn grown on the upland side of the borough was garnered by farmers who lived in an eastern purlieu called Durnover. Here wheat ricks overhung the old Roman street, and thrust their eaves against the church tower. Green thatched barns, with doorways as high as the gates of Solomon's temple, opened directly upon the main thoroughfare. Barns indeed were so numerous, as to alternate with every half dozen houses along the way. Here lived burgesses who daily walked the fallow, shepherds in an intramural squeeze. A street of farmers' homesteads, a street ruled by a mayor and corporation, yet echoing with the thump of the flail, the flutter of the winnowing fan, and the purr of the milk into the pails, a street which had nothing urban in it. Whatever this was, the Durnover end of Casterbridge. Henchard, as was natural, dealt largely with this nursery or bed of small farmers close at hand, and his wagons were often down that way. One day, when arrangements were in progress for getting home corn from one of the aforesaid farms, Elizabeth Jane received a note by hand, asking her to oblige the writer by coming at once to a granary on Durnover Hill. As this was the granary whose contents Henchard was removing, she thought the request had something to do with his business, and proceeded thither as soon as she had put on her bonnet. The granary was just within the farmyard, and stood on stone staddles, high enough for persons to walk under. The gates were open, but nobody was within. However, she entered and waited. Presently she saw a figure approaching the gate, that of Donald Farfrae. He looked up at the church clock, and came in. By some unaccountable shyness, some wish not to meet him there alone, she quickly ascended the step ladder leading to the granary door, and entered it, before he had seen her. Farfrae advanced, imagining himself in solitude, and a few drops of rain beginning to fall, he moved and stood under the shelter, whereas he had just been standing. Here he leant against one of the staddles, and gave himself up to patience. He, too, was plainly expecting someone. Could it be herself? If so, why? In a few minutes he looked at his watch, and then pulled out a note, a duplicate of the one she had herself received. This situation began to be very awkward, and the longer she waited the more awkward it became. To emerge from a door just above his head and descend the ladder, and show as he had been in hiding there, would look so very foolish, that she still waited on. A winnowing machine stood close beside her, and to relieve her suspense she gently moved the handle, whereupon a cloud of wheat husks flew out into her face, and covered her clothes and bonnet, and stuck into the fur of her victorine. He must have heard the slight movement, for he looked up, and then ascended the steps. "Ah, it's Miss Newson," he said as soon as he could see into the granary. "Didn't know you were there. I have kept the appointment, and am at your service." "Oh, Mr. Farfrae," she faltered, "so have one. but I didn't know it was you who wished to see me, otherwise I wished to see you. Oh no, at least, that is, I am afraid there may be a mistake. Didn't you ask me to come here? Didn't you write this? Elizabeth held out her note. No. Indeed, at no hand would I have thought of it. And for you, didn't you ask me? This is not your writing? And he held up his. By no means. And is that really so? Then it's somebody wanting to see us both. Perhaps we would do well to wait a little longer. Acting on this consideration, they lingered, Elizabeth Jane's face being arranged to an expression of preternatural composure, and the young Scot, at every footstep in the street without, looking from under the granary to see if the passer were about to enter and declare himself their summoner. They watched individual drops of rain creeping down the thatch of the opposite rick, straw after straw, till they reached the bottom. But nobody came, and the granary roof began to drip. The person is not likely to be coming, said Farfrae. It's a trick, perhaps, and if so, it's a great pity to waste our time like this, and so much to be done. 'Tis a great liberty, said Elizabeth. It's true, Miss Newson. We'll hear news of this someday, depend on't, and who it was that did it. I wouldn't stand for it hindering myself. But you, Miss Newson, I don't mind much, apostrophe, she replied. Neither do I. They lapsed again into silence. Who are anxious to get back to Scotland, I suppose, Mr. Farfrae, she inquired. Oh no, Miss Newson. Why would I be? I only supposed you might be from the song you sang at the Three Mariners about Scotland and home, I mean which you seemed to feel so deep down in your heart, so that we all felt for you. And I did sing there, I did, but, Miss Newson, and Donald's voice musically undulated between two semitones as it always did, when he became earnest, he's well, you feel a song for a few minutes, and your eyes they get quite tearful, but you finish it, and for all you felt you don't mind it, or think of it again for a long while. Oh no, I don't want to go back. Yet I'll sing the song to you, why pleasure, whenever you like. I could sing it now, and not mind at all. Thank you, indeed. But I fear I must go, rain or no. Eh? Then, Miss Newson, ye had better say nothing about this hoax, and take no heed of it. And if the person should say anything to you, be civil to him or her, as if you did not mind it, so you'll take the clever person's laugh away. And speaking, his eyes became fixed upon her dress, still sown with wheat husks. Here's husks and dust on you. Perhaps you don't know it? He said, in tones of extreme delicacy. And it's very bad to let rain come upon clothes when there's chaff on them. It washes in and spoils them. Let me help you, blowing is the best. As Elizabeth neither assented nor dissented, Donald Farfrae began blowing her back hair, and her side hair, and her neck, and the crown of her bonnet, and the fur of her victorine, Elizabeth saying, oh, thank you, at every puff. At last she was fairly clean, though Farfrae, having got over his first concern at the situation, seemed in no manner of hurry to be gone. Ah, now I'll go and get thee an umbrella, he said. She declined the offer, stepped out and was gone. Farfrae walked slowly after, looking thoughtfully at her diminishing figure, and whistling in undertones, as I came down through Kenobi. 15. At first Miss Newson's budding beauty was not regarded with much interest by anybody in Casterbridge. Donald Farfrae's gaze, it is true, was now attracted by the mayor's so-called stepdaughter, but he was only one. The truth is that she was but a poor illustrative instance of the Prophet Barrett's sly definition, colon, the virgin, that loveth to go gay. When she walked abroad she seemed to be occupied with an inner chamber of ideas, and to have slight need for visible objects. She formed curious resolves on checking gay fancies in the matter of clothes, because it was inconsistent with her past life to blossom gaudily the moment as he had become possessed of money. But nothing is more insidious than the evolution of wishes from mere fancies, and of wants from mere wishes. Henchard gave Elizabeth Jane a box of delicately tinted gloves one spring day. She wanted to wear them to show her appreciation of his kindness, but as he had no bonnet that would harmonize. As an artistic indulgence, she thought she would have such a bonnet. When as he had a bonnet that would go with the gloves, as he had no dress that would go with the bonnet. It was now absolutely necessary to finish. She ordered the requisite article, and found that as he had no sunshade to go with the dress. And for a penny and for a pound, she bought the sunshade, and the whole structure was at last complete. Everybody was attracted, and some said that her bygone simplicity was the art that conceals art, the elegant imposition of Rochefoucauld called, as he had produced an effect, a contrast, and it had been done on purpose. As a matter of fact, this was not true, but it had its result, for as soon as Casterbridge thought her artful, it thought her worth notice. "T is the first time in my life that I have been so much admired," she said to herself, "though perhaps it is by those whose admiration is not worth having." But Donald Farfrae admired her too, and altogether the time was an exciting one. Sex had never before asserted itself in her so strongly, for in former days as he had perhaps been too impersonally human to be distinctively feminine. After an unprecedented success one day, she came indoors, went upstairs, and leant upon her bed face downwards, quite forgetting the possible creasing and damage. "Good heaven," she whispered, "can it be? Here am I setting up as the town beauty." When as he had thought it over, her usual fear of exaggerating appearances engendered a deep sadness. "Here is something wrong in all this," she mused. "If they only knew what an unfinished girl I am, that I can't talk Italian, or use globes, or show any of the accomplishments they learn at boarding schools, how they would despise me. Better sell all this finery, and buy myself grammar books and dictionaries, and a history of all the philosophies." She looked from the window and saw Henchard and Farfrae in the hay yard talking, with that impetuous cordiality on the mayor's part, and genial modesty on the younger man's, that was now so generally observable in their intercourse. Friendship between man and man, what a rugged strength there was in it, as evinced by these two. And yet the seed, that was to lift the foundation of this friendship, was at that moment taking root in a chink of its structure. It was about 6 o'clock. The men were dropping off homeward one by one. The last to leave was a round-shouldered, blinking young man of 19 or 20, whose mouth fell ajar on the slightest provocation, seemingly because there was no chin to support it. Henchard called aloud to him as he went out of the gate, "Here, Abel Whittle." Whittle turned, and ran back a few steps. "Yes, sir," he said, in breathless deprecation, as if he knew what was coming next. "Once more be in time tomorrow morning. You see what's to be done, and you hear what I say, and you know I'm not going to be trifled with any longer." "Yes, sir." Then Abel Whittle left, and Henchard and Farfrae, and Elizabeth saw no more of them. Now there was good reason for this command on Henchard's part. Poor Abel, as he was called, had an inveterate habit of oversleeping himself, and coming late to his work. His anxious will was to be among the earliest, but if his comrades omitted to pull the string that he always tied round his great toe, and left hanging out the window for that purpose, his will was as wind. He did not arrive in time. As he was often second-hand at the hay weighing, or at the crane which lifted the sacks, or was one of those who had to accompany the wagons into the country to fetch away stacks that had been purchased, this affliction of Abel's was productive of much inconvenience. For 2 mornings in the present week he had kept the others waiting nearly an hour, hence Henchard's threat. It now remained to be seen what would happen tomorrow. 6 o'clock struck, and there was no Whittle. At 6:30 Henchard entered the yard. The wagon was horsed, that Abel was to accompany, and the other man had been waiting 20 minutes. Then Henchard swore, and Whittle coming up breathless at that instant, the corn factor turned on him, and declared with an oath, that this was the last time, that if he were behind once more, by God, he would come and drag him out o' bed. There is something wrong in my make, your worshipful, said Abel, especially in the inside. Whereas my poor dumb brain gets as dead as a clod afore I've said my few scraps of prayers. Yes, it came on as a stripling, just afore I'd got man's wages, whereas I never enjoy my bed at all, for no sooner do I lie down than I be asleep, and afore I be awake I be up. I fretted my gizzard green about it, maester, but what can I do? Now last night, afore I went to bed, I only had a scantily no cheese and I don't want to hear it, roared Henchard. Oh, morrow the wagons must start at 4, and if you're not here, stand. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.